Afghan security forces report heavy fighting in Kunduz.
The Taliban continues to take over Afghan cities. This is Monday, the 9th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, a closer look at an Afghan woman in danger who made her way to the U.S. A wrap-up on the Olympic Games, turning marine waste into building blocks. The pandemic has already set back some of the most vulnerable students before they spend even one day in a classroom. Residents of an Indian village live in terror of wild elephants. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Taliban fighters have seized key government buildings in the northeastern Afghan city of Kunduz, leaving government forces hanging onto control of the airport and their own base. A provincial assembly lawmaker said that Sunday. Matthew Larentanda reports.
The Taliban offensive across Afghanistan has now seen the group seize control of several key official buildings in the city of Kunduz, leaving only the city's airport and a military base in control of the government. That's according to a local politician. This video released by the Taliban is said to show its fighters walking through the police headquarters there. The politician told Reuters that militants have also taken control of government buildings in another city, the capital of Saripol province. Similar reports are coming from at least two other cities as well. The news comes only a day after the funeral of a senior spokesperson for President Ashraf Ghani's government, who was assassinated by the Taliban. In recent days, the Taliban have taken a third city, Zaranj, the first provincial capital seized by the group in years, and there are hundreds of people stuck on the border with Pakistan, which was closed after the Taliban took control of a crossing there last month. Afghan security forces report heavy fighting in Kunduz, a strategic location and home to 270,000 people. The Taliban's advance has gained momentum as American and allied forces withdraw from the country.
That was Reuters reporter Matthew Larentanda. Overall, the Taliban fighters overran three provincial capitals as the insurgents intensified pressure on the north and threatened further cities. The insurgents have taken dozens of districts and border crossings in recent months and put pressure on several provincial capitals, including Herat in the west and Kandahar in the south, as foreign troops withdraw. The offensive has gathered momentum in recent days after the United States announced it would end its military mission in the country by the end of August. Health officials in Kunduz said that 14 bodies, including those of women and children, and more than 30 injured people had been taken to the hospital. The Taliban have also taken government buildings in the northern provincial capital of Saripol, driving officials out of the main city to a nearby military base. On Friday, they captured their first provincial capital in years when they took control of Zaranj on the border with Iran in Afghanistan's northern Nimroz province. This is VOA Asia. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un mobilizes the military to carry out relief work in areas recently hit by heavy rains amid concerns over an economic crisis and food shortage. Anti-military protest in Myanmar on anniversary of the 1988 uprising. U.S. says the plot against the Myanmar UN envoy fits disturbing pattern. Thai police charge local man with murder of a Swiss tourist on Phuket. India raids banned religious organization in an alleged terrorism funding case. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The U.S. has begun granting special immigrant visas to thousands of Afghans whose work for the U.S. military has made them vulnerable to attacks by the Taliban as the militants rapidly extend their control over the country. VOA's Madi Merayin spoke with one woman who left Afghanistan as part of a previous stage of the SIV program.
32-year-old Afghan architect Masuma Dilijam left her country for America in 2017. She was worried her work on U.S.-funded development projects in Afghanistan made her a Taliban target. One of those projects involved helping restore the Dar al-Aman Palace in Kabul that suffered major damage in Afghanistan's civil war of the 1990s. She recalls an encounter with the Taliban while working in another part of Afghanistan.
I was in Kandahar with a team of Afghan colleagues driving for a site visit to a U.S.-funded project. Our driver realized that a car was following us. We changed our route and immediately called the Afghan security forces. They came, and then the car disappeared. Later on, the security forces told us that Taliban militants were trying to capture us. Luckily, the Taliban couldn't do anything. I think if they had captured us, I would not be alive now.
Dilijam decided to start a new life with her husband and young son in the United States and gained entry through a special immigrant visa or SIV program. She now works for a construction company in Washington.
Given the insecurity in Afghanistan, the SIV program was an opportunity for those who worked on the U.S. projects to live in greater peace and security. I am certainly pleased with it.
The Taliban released statements in early June saying Afghans who worked with U.S. forces will be safe as long as they show remorse and do not seek exile. But the U.S. group No One Left Behind says militants' attacks against interpreters working with the U.S. in Afghanistan, along with their family members, have killed more than 300 people since 2014. Dilijam worries her parents, brothers, and sisters in Kabul are at risk as U.S.-led forces leave Afghanistan.
For most of the Afghans who live here, our bodies are here, but our souls are with our families back home. When they are not safe, when there is war and insecurity every day, all I care about is their survival.
This IV program benefits both the U.S. and Afghanistan, according to Afghan sociology professor Hassan Rezaei.
It proves the moral commitment of the United States to the safety of its partners in Afghanistan. The program also has a social impact. The immigration to the United States of tens of thousands of Afghans who help the U.S. military will create a vast social network that can communicate with Afghanistan and share life experiences with people there.
The U.S. government says 70,000 Afghans have immigrated to the United States since 2008 under the SIV program. Last week, it began the process of bringing another 2,500 Afghans to safety with the arrival of around 200 people at Fort Lee, Virginia. Mahdi Mihrain for VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, China stepped up measures to protect its capital, Beijing, as an uptick in coronavirus cases spread across multiple cities in the country. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. The Tokyo Olympics are over. Steve Ross has the wrap-up.
Olympic athletes of all nations marched into Tokyo's mostly empty national stadium on Sunday evening, taking selfie photos and blowing kisses to the television cameras that, for this pandemic Olympics, served to take the place of live audiences. As white and gold fireworks lit up the sky above the Olympic stadium, the athletes interacted with performers whose music and circus tricks gave the final events the relaxed atmosphere of a street festival. However, some of the Olympians were unable to attend Sunday's closing event. Due to COVID-19 safety restrictions, they had to return home 48 hours after their final competition. The final weekend of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics held plenty of excitement. Brazil beat Spain to capture the Olympic gold in men's soccer on Saturday. Kenya continued its dominance in the marathon after a gold and silver finish in the women's event, and Eliud Kipchoge defended his Olympic men's marathon title in brutal conditions in Sapporo. Team USA showed its prowess in basketball, capturing its fourth straight Olympic men's gold medal on Saturday and seventh straight gold medal in the women's event on Sunday. Japan took the silver in its first appearance in an Olympics women's basketball medal round. And Team USA won its first Olympic gold medal ever in women's volleyball, beating Brazil in straight sets. The U.S. women's strong showing throughout the games in part helped Team USA top the gold medal count in the end and maintain its first place in the overall medal count, both beating Team China at the Tokyo Olympics. While originally intended to showcase Japan's recovery from the 2011 Fukushima earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear crisis, the Games instead became a pandemic Olympics and the first Olympic Games to be postponed rather than simply canceled. While Japanese citizens told pollsters that they worried about hosting a possible super spreader event during the COVID-19 crisis, once underway, attitudes appeared to shift toward the positive. The 32nd Olympiad allowed viewers around the world to acknowledge mental health issues in athletics, diversity in the form of LGBTQ participation, and multiculturalism, as represented by biracial tennis star Naomi Osaka, who lit the starting Olympics cauldron flame. The flame and the competition in the spirit of international cooperation will continue when the Paralympic Games get underway here in Tokyo on August 24th. Steve Ross for VOA News, Tokyo.
U.S. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden held a virtual meeting over the weekend with the U.S. Olympic team. The president told the Olympians they had made America proud with their performances and invited them to come to the White House in the fall so, quote, I can brag more on you. He told the group, you remind us of what an amazing country we are.
And you represented every single thing that we stand for. You really did. And I just think that, it wasn't just for a lot of you, it wasn't just your athletic ability, it was your moral courage.
The anticipated star of this year's Olympics was gymnast Simone Biles, who pulled out during the competition, citing mental health issues. Biden told her, you had the courage to say, I need some help, I need some time. He also praised Biles for her return to the games. And guess what? He said, you got back up on that damn beam. Doing a flip on a 4-inch beam is my idea of going to purgatory. Overall, the U.S. won 113 medals, 39 of them gold, 41 silver, and 33 bronze, leading in the total count and in each category.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed deep concern about China's growing nuclear arsenal during a meeting with foreign ministers of Asian countries and partner nations. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
Business Scene. I'm Amy Hybels. Alarmed by the mountains of plastic waste leaching into Indonesia's waters, two best friends are taking on the environmental menace by turning crisp bags and shampoo packets into paving bricks. Ovi Sabrina and Novita Tan launched Rebricks after their country drew headlines as the second biggest producer of marine waste in the world, behind China. Indonesia has pledged to reduce plastic waste by some 75% over the next 4 years, a mammoth task in the Southeast Asian nation of nearly 270 million people. The pair got their start 2 years ago visiting food stalls across the capital, Jakarta, on the hunt for discarded instant coffee sachets, dry noodle packs, and shopping bags. Thanks to a viral social media campaign, the pair now receive reams of plastic waste packaging from donors across the country. Novita Tan, Rebricks founder.
Since the pandemic, the amount of plastic rubbish sent to us has been increasing. We have three drop points for collecting plastic waste. Daily, we receive up to 50 kilograms of plastic waste that has been sorted and cleaned. This shows the people have high enthusiasm for recycling rubbish.
Rebrick's staff mulch the packaging into tiny flakes that are then mixed with cement and sand and molded into building blocks. They may look like conventional bricks, but break one open and it is dotted with flecks of plastic. The two women hope to expand their company, which employs four people, and said they were in talks with a big consumer goods firm about a possible collaboration. In efforts to cut costs and increase efficiency in separating PET water bottles and increase overall recycling rates, in December of 2020, the South Korean government made it mandatory for each household in apartment complexes and multi-unit housing to dispose transparent PET water bottles separately from colored plastic bottles when putting them out for collection. The costs of producing long fibers used to make clothes with recycled PET plastic is almost double the cost of making fiber with new plastic and is not yet an economic choice for most companies. However, the South Korean government is encouraging companies to use recycled plastics. And Black Yak, an outdoor wear company, is an example of a company leading the sector. High-quality flakes can be used to make plastic sheets for food packaging or long fiber, which can be used to make clothes. Mid-quality flakes can be used to make short fiber, which can be used for the fill put inside puffer jackets or duvets. The South Korean Ministry of National Defense and the National Police Agency have agreed to purchase 12,000 new clothing items for outdoor activities and casual on-duty uniforms from Black Yak. The Defense Ministry will buy 10,000 sets of clothing and the police force 2,000. For Business Scene, I'm Amy Heibels.
Making headlines in Asia, Indonesia's most volatile volcano erupted Sunday on the densely populated island of Java. No casualties have been reported. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a New York Times report says as the coronavirus swept across the U.S., more than a million children, many of them in poor neighborhoods, failed to show up for public school classes, either online or in person. The steepest decline, the report said, was among kindergarten students. The newspaper said more than 340,000 kindergarten children did not show up for instruction. Analysis of the data, said the Times, shows that the pandemic has already set back some of the most vulnerable students before they spend even one day in a classroom. The World Health Organization says more than 700 healthcare workers and patients were killed, more than 2,000 injured, and hundreds of health facilities destroyed in countries of conflict between 2018 and 2020. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A three-year analysis was carried out in 17 conflict-ridden countries and territories, including Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, Mozambique, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Myanmar. New data show that healthcare continues to be under attack. So far this year, the World Health Organization has recorded 588 incidents in 14 countries with emergencies, causing 114 deaths and 278 injuries of healthcare workers and patients. The WHO's Director of Health Emergencies Interventions, Altaf Moussani, says the impact of those healthcare attacks goes well beyond claiming lives. He says the ramifications are significant and alarming, especially considering the ongoing COVID-19 response.
Their impact reverberates on healthcare workers' mental health and willingness to report to work, equally on communities' willingness to seek health care, and also drastically reduces resources for responding to a health crisis, amongst others.
Moussani says the ripple effect of a single incident is huge and has a long-lasting impact on the system at large. When health facilities are destroyed, he says, they need to be rebuilt. When healthcare workers are killed or wounded, he says a vital workforce must be reinforced. Building back those vital systems, he says, requires years of costly investment, years in which people in need are underserved.
During the pandemic, more than ever, healthcare workers must be protected, must be respected. Hospitals and healthcare facilities including the transportation of ambulances, should not be used for military purposes. Essential conditions for the continued delivery of vital health care must be given the necessary space.
Moussami notes any reduction in capacity will interrupt services and deprive vulnerable communities of urgent care. The WHO is calling on all parties in conflicts to ensure safe working spaces for the delivery of healthcare services. It says people caught in emergency situations must be able to safely access care free from violence, threat, or fear. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We continue on VOA Asia. Residents of a village in eastern India are spending sleepless nights living in the terror of wild elephants who are driven away from their habitats due to illegal mining. Maha Albadrawi reports.
The residents of a village called Karanjia in eastern India are spending sleepless nights worrying about wild elephants, who they say have been destroying crops and even some of their homes, all because the elephants are reacting to illegal mining operations in the area. Explosives used in the mines particularly drive the wild animals away, moving to human settlements in search of shelter and food, destroying property, and sometimes even injuring humans along the way. This is wildlife expert Vanumitra Acharya.
Elephants from either Jharkhand or from Simli Park wreak havoc in this area around the year. The main reason for its illegal mining in eco-sensitive zones. Nobody pays any attention to it, to control it.
Elephants are worshipped in India, and the elephant-headed god Ganesh is one of the most popular in the Hindu pantheon. India has over half of the world's Asiatic elephant population, but their number has dwindled in recent years.
That was Reuters' Maha Albadrawi reporting. Australia is to compensate some survivors of a former assimilation policy that separated Indigenous children from their families. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
Members of the so-called Stolen Generations in the Australian Capital Territory, the region surrounding the capital Canberra, and the Northern Territory will receive a one-off payment of $60,000. It's part of an $800 million program to address the disadvantages faced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as a result of the continued trauma of historic family separations. Most Australian states have their own reparation schemes, but authorities in Queensland and Western Australia are being urged to do more to compensate survivors of the Stolen Generations. Tens of thousands of Indigenous Australian children were removed over several decades until the early 1970s. It was a deliberate policy to assimilate often mixed-race children into white society. Eileen Cummins was taken as a child from her family in Australia's Northern Territory. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that her memories are still vivid.
Without no indication that they were going to remove me. They never told my mother. My mother was watching them take me away in the truck, but she couldn't say anything. Here I am, this 4.5-year-old kid on the back of a truck with a patrol officer. And where did they take me? To the Maranboy police station. When they took me away, I just kept crying because I wanted my mother and my people.
In February 2008, the Australian government formally apologised for forcibly taking Indigenous children from their families. Australia's original inhabitants make up just over 3% of the population and suffer high levels of disadvantage. The government in Canberra last year said it would reset its efforts to improve Indigenous life expectancy, which is about 10 years less than the general population, as well as inequalities in education. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thank you to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Lescao, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Milne. Please take care of yourself and enjoy the day ahead.